international events. The first one is South Africa's successful election in the United Nations Security Council. This must be noted. Noted that the UN Security Council has voted for 5 countries to take up the non-permanent seats in the UN Security Council. South Africa has been bidding to take one of the seats reserved for the African countries, of which the outgoing member is Uganda. And South Africa was successful in its bid, and that secured the required number of votes to be elected into the non-permanent seat. So as this portfolio committee, we should welcome a distinct demonstration of confidence in South Africa by the members of the United Nations by voting for her, voting this country in with an overwhelming 182 number of votes to represent the Africa region. Now South Africa has a major task. A major task at hand is to fulfill its mandate as a responsible member of the international community. And South Africa will be together with some of the biggest allies, including Brazil and India, who are part of the forum which had been initiated called IPSA. And whose countries are also part of this international significant forum, the BRIC formation, which includes the permanent Security Council members, Russia and China. So it's apparent, therefore, that South Africa's election to the Security Council carries what we would call an immense potential for achieving the country's strategic goal. As the committee will be releasing a statement on that, and will circulate the statement to the members. One of the international events unfolding relates to the Chile miners' rescue. We've been following the news of that rescue mission, which commenced on Tuesday, the 12th of October, for those 33 miners who've been trapped underground for almost 69 days. As they emerged to take the whiffs of fresh air, we saw they were greeted with cheers and applause from the members of their families and supporters standing by the hillside near that mine shaft. We indeed are heartened by such an effort, which has taken weeks of planning by a mix of individuals and bodies from both sides and outside Chile, which is a true example of international cooperation. There were no leftists and right-wingers, no capitalists and communists there. But there were still the exploiters and the exploited. The miners were now the symbol of hope, resilience and national pride. Have spent a long time deep down in the bowels of the earth, where they were supposed to dig for gold and copper. They've managed to survive this ordeal, which could have destroyed any weakened soul. Their hope for survival lay in their unity and ability to work together and support from the rest. efforts of the rescue mission, which made their stay underground as bearable as possible by taking down regular supplies of food, water, hydration material, entertainment, as well as letters from the families and the close friends to lift their spirits. South Africa should take pride in the fact that a local company was involved in the rescue effort. The South African construction giant Marain Roberts took part in the mission by availing its strata, the Strata 950 drilling machine that created a huge body size shaft through which the miners would be hoisted up to the surface via the steel cage capsule, which is aptly named as the Phoenix. So we congratulate this rescue effort and hope that it will encourage many throughout the international community and assist in driving the message home that success in unity cannot just be profits and profits and only profits. Thank you. So we will release a statement. It is my duty, honorable members, and the privilege you gave me, that from time to time I must be able to release statements. Let's come back to our agenda. Honorable Makhao and Makama, yes. I don't see you.
We are here, Chair. I just said please. Then he said you're coming back to the offense.
Why are you so far?
The room is not for you, offense.
Yeah, he's a killer. He's a killer of strength.
Do you have any apologies? Honorable Sunduza is overseas. That's the apology we have. We have an apology from Honorable Tawa. We have a permanent apology of Honorable Olomisa. I thought other things are over, but they seem not yet to be over. Is he still resolving those issues? So Honorable Ngonyama is not here. Is he where? In court? What is it? Order, Honorable. Colleagues, we're going into the main item. Without much ado, we know that the DG pleaded with us that we meet a bit early, we're already late. Let us give him an opportunity. Let's welcome the department as led by him with a number of DDGs and other officials. Of course, DG, with your permanent ambassador here, Ambassador Hooper, we managed to hit to the request, although we were delayed by just a few issues. There are a lot of meetings. There's a lot going on here. DG, let's hand over to you to present your annual report.
Thanks to the honorable member. We do have colleagues in the department who in their CVs do write that they were ambassadors of the Botswana or the Transkei to South Africa. So Ambassador Hopa is following on their footsteps. Now, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, thanks ever so much for affording us the opportunity. We have our DDG for Africa, Mkholisi Nkosi. We've got our DDG in transit, DDT Matutu Ini, and just to say to the honorable members, you'll probably, I think, for the last time in that role, she will be our, she's our High Commissioner designate to Jamaica, covering virtually all the Caribbean islands. So Matu will be leaving in November.
Wow.
And then maybe let me just place on record that as you see the progress we've made, thanks to her efforts, and I will come back to that. We also have Mr. Gosso, the head of our internal audit. Let me and Ambassador Hooper and Mr. Conrad, who's from our training academy. Tian Creek works with me in my office. And let me apologize for our chief financial officer. She's been, well, this is around the time when we have what we call midterm reviews with all our heads of corporate services in our missions to do midterm budget reviews and see whether spending is on track, or major programs, which is one of the initiatives instituted some time back to improve our financial management. Chair, there's the slight document. I will really run through it because it was circulated in advance, the presentation. There's also another three-pager that I just said must be given to the members of the committee. And that three-pager is a document like this. And essentially we thought we should just give you a sense of really, we're looking at a point in time and looking at our audit the audit findings of the Auditor General. But just to give you a sense of what has happened over the past 5-6 years. And so that as we celebrate the third year of not only an unqualified audit report, but essentially a report which is, so to say, a clean audit, because the Auditor General also has not put any matters of emphasis. As I say, this is the third year in succession. Just to give you a sense that there's been some long journey to reach this point, and we give you a sense of the issues, and in the document at the end, for the purpose of the members, we also outline a whole string of measures that over time the department has been implementing in order to get to where we are. Now, coming back to the annual report, members, the first slide we just indicate, again reiterating the strategic priorities of the department, and we've spoken about this before, African agenda, South-South, relations with the North, global system of governance, and of course the need to improve our organization. And we also then in the next slide deal with the elements of that organizational strengthening, issues of the establishment, recruitment and selection, talent management, employee wellness, and we give a hint of what we take as the strategic priorities for 2011. The next slide details what the number of filled and vacant positions. What we would like to just draw your attention to is, of course, what we've written there is vacant unfunded positions, which really those are positions that we need, but in the current economic climate it's virtually impossible for us to fill those positions. The next slide details a bit of gender representativity, or breakdown by category of the membership of the department. The next slide gives you a sense of the turnover rates. 9% is a bit high for what we are used to. Normally the turnover rate of the department is 6-7% or so. Most of these are promotions to other departments, and people in retirement. The next slide we indicate, of course, members, we know that one of the issues we are all asked to follow is to look at the status of women at SMS level, and we are really hovering around 33%. We know we should be aiming for 50%, but we're not there yet. The same with the people with disabilities, 1.54%. The target is 2%. And again, as I've explained before, this is not out of a lack of trying. We have partnered with the organizations representing people with disabilities to assist us, especially. look for them to help us search. Now, this is a slide that is a source of pride, particularly to our DDG, Matshwane Mpozo, especially in the second slide, the second bullet, which says that Deko was rated as second best employer of choice by tertiary students studying towards qualifications in humanities. Now, this is something, the initiative of IHR to benchmark ourselves against other employers with respect to university leaving students, in a sense to keep on checking what the external perception of the department is. Of course, part of this has been a result of also outreach programs to the universities, to the schools, inviting young people to see a future in diplomacy. Now, we've spoken before about the cadet program is continuing well, and it remains a good talent pipeline to meet our human resource needs. Now, on employee wellness, again, this is a major area of focus for the department. Sometimes, last time we presented, we indicated a number of initiatives that we had started. I think the ones that we'd like to highlight is around enhancing the support for employees in hardship missions. What we did, a team led by Ms. Mpozo, visited some of our hardship missions, your Guinea-Conakry, your Guinea-Bissau, to see on the spot what life is like, so that from an HR perspective, we can try also to design programs of support. That also led us to a recommendation that the HR team made, which we've endorsed as a top management and endorsed by our minister, which is now a policy, that actually in some of these missions, the rotation period should be reduced from 4 years to 2 years, largely because some of the people are forced purely not to take their spouses or not to take their children, and of course this dislocation of families. And as an incentive, what we've done is, for example, if you go to that mission, you go spend 2 years, and immediately back to back with that, we offer you an opportunity to go for 4 years into one of the category one or two missions. So in fact, after would be called the hardship mission, you then go to what in Deko parlance is called an ice cream mission. So that's what we are trying to do, just to assist our. Then the other one is really trying to establish a proper spousal support office. We increasingly are finding that spouses, particularly of our ambassadors, want to receive some particular attention and briefed in their own right in terms of the expectations that we have. And then you can see some of them want to have a far much more robust engagement. And of course, there's a very delicate line there, empowering people to play the supportive role, but at the same time keep on remembering that they are not the employees of the state. Their partners are, so, but nevertheless to try. But we've also come to the conclusion that in light of some of the complaints we keep on getting sometimes about domestic issues, that we can't be indifferent to the extent that they may project or reflect negatively on the country, that a proper spousal support office is necessary. That's what we're doing. Now, one point we've not mentioned here, which we mentioned last time we presented to you, is that under our employee wellness, we've now started essentially 24/7, that any official anywhere in the world can access that service, so that if there's any immediate crisis the family gets to, then that they can get support. These are the strategic priorities for 2010-2011. This is really what we're focusing on.
The honourable members would order. This is for honourable members.
Thank you very much. So those are strategic priorities for the next year. Now, with respect to the DTRD, just to say all our programs that we offer at the Institute are fully accredited. But what we are also increasingly finding is the growing role of our training institute in support of our African agenda. And I'll come back to that. Those are the numbers of heads of missions that we've trained, the protocol, and you can see that in terms of protocol training, significant numbers this time, because it also had a lot of support for the preparation for 2010. We also have a language training program where we're finding increasingly that we're providing that service to other departments of the state. I've spoken about the cadet program. We're offering internships. We're offering learnerships. We've got individuals who are undergoing the other program. And of course, one of our more recent flagship programs is the master's program in diplomacy. And I must at this point congratulate two of our DDGs who've gone through that program, and they've acquitted themselves well, Chair. And those two DDGs that I really want to congratulate is DDG Mxolisi and DDG Motlong. And of course, one of them even got promotion and is now a DG of Tourism, Ambassador Makubela. That was the group that went through this master's program. We have now the second group. The minister has just approved a recommendation that we presented that we now, after two intakes, we are going to use that master's program of Turkey to basically make it a regional program. We'll support it, we'll sponsor it, but we want to get senior officials from the rest of the region as part of our contribution to strengthening of diplomacy in the region. Chair, you've been worried about our focus on economic diplomacy, and I would suggest at some point that we brief this committee about in detail. That would be a presentation on its own about what measures we're taking. But just to say that we're spending a lot of time on that, we also partnered with UNITA, and you can see that we, through the e-learning process, really around multilateral diplomacy, and again, we recruit a number of people from the region in terms of that. We've got the project with the DRC on capacity building, where we essentially literally are sponsoring the training of the DRC diplomats. And I must say, this has given a lot of led to a lot of recognition being given to South Africa in the diplomatic training avenue. Now, with respect to the African agenda, having done that, the issues I want to just highlight is the issue of the African Charter on Democracy, which was signed in February this year. Of course, Chairperson have already commented about the UN seat. I will not go back to that, save to place on record our profound gratitude to the continent for supporting us. And of course, the PAWO had got us just to say that we are working closely with PAWO to assist as much as we can for the firm establishment of that office here. The next one is the NEPAD. Now, the summit formally established the NEPAD Planning and Coordinating Agency. The issue has been sorted out that that agency is going to be in South Africa. We signed a host agreement, and basically what we are now doing is in the process of spending more time on the implementation of the programs. Now, there's a huge, exciting initiative around infrastructure that South Africa has been asked to pioneer, but I will not spend time on that because this is more for the 2010-2011 financial year. On the regional integration issues, the two obstacles, of course, we continue to face during the period under review as Madagascar and Zimbabwe. And as well as we've not progressed much on the issue of economic integration in the region. Progress is being made, but nevertheless not at the pace that we believe is necessary. So that's work in progress. Now, Chair, we've just given you a sense of some of the visits that the President undertook in the region. Angola, Zambia, Namibia during the period under review. Lastly, because of a strategic decision that we've made that we must strengthen political relations, all-round relations with the countries in our region. With respect to North Africa, of course, we've restored relations with Mauritania following the democratic elections of July 2009. And I guess in our new role now as members of the Security Council, we will have to work closely with Algeria and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic to see to what extent we can give a further push to the efforts of the people of Sahrawi for self-determination. But Western Central Africa, visits to Equatorial Guinea, celebration of 10th anniversary of relations with Nigeria, holding of the DNC with Nigeria, PJCC between South Africa and Ghana, inauguration of the Ahmed Baba Institute in Timbuktu, and of course the support for the Cuban medical brigades in Sierra Leone were all activities that we undertook this year. With respect to East Africa, just to emphasize that we've kept a close watch during this period on the implementation of the SP of the CPA because of the profound implications it has for our continent. We also tried to follow very closely developments with respect to Somalia, visits to Uganda, and also, of course, during this period, we concluded the peace process in Burundi. Now, with respect to Madagascar, as we've indicated, we did focus on the support to the Chisano facilitation and mediation. With South-South relations, I think we participated in the NAM summit, and we're highlighting it particularly because it was a very important point in our efforts to have the international community recognizing the Nelson Mandela International Day, because once NAM supported that, it made our work at the United Nations far much more easier as a way of recognizing our icon. With respect to the North-South cooperation, I think we continue to consolidate the relations with the EU. We had all the necessary meetings that were scheduled for that year. And generally, we've been happy with the progress in terms of our bilateral relations, save, of course, for the perennial problem of the EPAS. Apart from that, I don't think there are any other major issues of dispute between us and the EU. Now, there are certain formalities that we needed to do, like, for example, acceding to the revised Cotonou Partnership Agreement, which we did, and of course the problems of the EPAS. We continue to engage. Of course, there's beginning to be some light a bit now, but again, this is not something to talk about now because that's more for the 2010-2011 report. OECD, an important development around this time was really the decision by OECD Council to place South Africa on the enhanced engagement status. Problem with this enhanced engagement status, which we assist with now, is really to have a debate in our own cabinet so that everybody can have a common understanding of what it is, exactly means. Because South Africa has at the same time taken a decision that we still want to examine our options with respect to joining the OECD. We've been invited, but it has profound implications for our membership of the other formations of the South, particularly the G77 and China and also the NAM. Now, we don't want to lose that because that's where our strength lies. But that's an issue that's currently under discussion. Now, of course, during this time, we participated in a number of multilateral initiatives, the issue of the climate change being one of them, both the high-level summit on climate change and, of course, the Copenhagen summit. On the reform, really nothing new except to continue our agenda for being advocates for all the negotiations that are taking place, whether it's finance or WTO or whatever. Whether it's the topical issue is the reform of the multilateral system, we've been participating in that. An important development, I must say, though, is our membership of the G20, largely because it has enabled us to further, given us a platform to further advance that program of using the G20 to accelerate and speed up the process of the reform, particularly of the Bretton Woods institutions. And of course, we followed again the work that we started during our tenure of the Security Council with respect to the coordination between the AU and the UN. This is one of the important things that we did, which was the evaluation of the UN system. Essentially what this is about, Honorable Member, is that if you look at the UN and the entities like the UNDP, they tend to interact in a particular way with the developing world. Now, we've always had a sense that this way of interaction does not really reflect where South Africa is as a middle-income country, and therefore we needed to nuance a bit our engagement with the UN system. And so we did a study, commissioned a study together, which we did with the UN, which I must say has been well received within the UN because it started suggesting a different way that the UN must interface with countries of the level of South Africa in order to ensure mutual benefit. And so what we are now focusing on is the implementation of that. And I must say we are then in the process of implementation. We are going to have a study tour which is going to be carried out by the UNDP, representative from the Treasury, President Sendiko, visiting particularly India and Brazil, amongst others. These are just activities, and again, the UN Security Council we've spoken about. No major issues to highlight, really, but the continuation of the normal work within the IAEA. Just to say, of course, we had those talks with the U.S. on non-proliferation in November 2009, which were really setting the scene for the April meeting that the President participated in. Now, on the G20, all that I really want to highlight, in addition to what is in the slides, is that one of the tricky issues that South Africa is going to face in the coming few months is obviously how we participate in this forum like the G20, where the center of gravity is really shifting in the direction of this body for major decision making on economic governance, and at the same time reconcile our participating in these smaller elite groups like the G20 with our general political, ideological, and principle stand about our support for an inclusive multilateralism, so that our membership must not make us so comfortable that actually we end up alienating us, both in terms of our actions and in terms of our own principles, from making sure that the rest of the members of the UN participate in issues of broader global governance. I think that's the challenge, in addition to the issues that we face there. Of course, on the climate change issues, we've worked together with the relevant Department of Government, and of course, the main issue that we've been building up systematically towards is the issue really of participating in the so-called major economies and participating in Copenhagen. Now we're full steam preparing for Cancun, but all of that is part of the build-up to COP17 here. Now, one of the very tricky things we had to do last year was really the participation in the review of the Durban conference, and this was a meeting that was difficult, first of all, to hold because many people didn't want the review to take place. And, of course, it was also at some importance because it was going to give us a good signal on how the Obama administration, the U.S., that has up to now taken a very distant view of this initiative, how it was going to relate. And as is, the Obama administration really did not actively participate in this review conference. This gives us significant challenges. And of course, there was the review also of the UN Commission on the Status of Women, largely a review of the Beijing Declaration, and South Africa participated. I think the Kimberley process, we continue to participate, nothing dramatic except a major topical issue during this period was really the discovery of the diamond fields in Marange, the interface between Zimbabwe and the Kimberley process. And South Africa, I think, was one of those countries that argued strongly for the agreement on the roadmap, the plan that Zimbabwe needed to honor in order for those Marange diamonds to be put in the general commercial pool. In Asia and Middle East, Japan centennial celebrations, relations remain good. Now, just to say that with respect to Korea, we've looked at Republic of Korea as a major source, perhaps, of technological support to South Africa. And of course, as you know, the DP was there now, continuing the process that we had started, and again, a major source of possible partnership with South Africa in the nuclear field. Now, it so happens that Republic of Korea also, at this time, is going to be chairing the G20, so there was a need for us to engage far more strongly with them, and we're happy with what has happened. Now, there's a lot we can say about China, but suffice to highlight some of the points that are there. Our joint membership of BASIC, increased investment by the Chinese into the South African the economy, and of course the successful hosting of FOCAC, and the decision that was taken around this time that South Africa will host the next the FOCAC in 2015, which therefore will give us space to work very closely with the Chinese in the next few years. I think here this is far much more for information really in South Asia. And in Southeast Asia, I guess we are highlighting the issue around Myanmar, if only to emphasize the point about our stance that we've taken on this issue, given the previous criticism that we've had. In Australasia, again, I don't think, apart from what I've put on the slides, that there's anything dramatic except to continue the relations. And I must say, with the success of the Labour government in Australia, that gave us a bit of a space to re-establish and strengthen the relations with the Australian government. Now, of course, Australia, we are cooperating in science and technology, but we're also competitors, and one classical example of that is with respect to the Square Kilometre Array. Also, just to indicate that we formally opened our mission in Wellington, and I must say, by so doing, we probably closed a huge grievance on the side of the New Zealanders, who had always felt that they did so much during the apartheid struggle, and yet they were amongst the last that were recognized by having the honor of establishing a full diplomatic mission there. Gulf states, we continued to do work focusing largely on economic cooperation. I don't think there's anything that I want to emphasize there. Again, with respect to the Levant, the major driving issue, of course, was around the Richard Goldstone report, the stance that we took, and the problems that we had with how the Israeli government had handled the Gaza issue and things like those. But essentially battled through 2009 and 2010 with just holding on, raising the moral, being a voice that joins those who've been raising the problems around the Israeli conduct and behavior, but also struggling to promote the unity of the Palestinians. I must say 2009 and 2010 also saw a lot of thawing in our relations with Syria, and those will culminate, I think, in the next month or so. The deputy president is going to Syria, which I think has been a very good thing for us. The U.S., again, I don't think major issues, except again we're reconnected with the U.S. I think the fact that Hillary Clinton is a Secretary of State and in a sense familiar with the period of the when we had the binational commission with the United States, I think that's what made her very warm to the idea of really formalizing the relationship between South Africa and the United States. We'd always felt that although our relations were warm, although we worked well, but we felt that the absence of some sort of a structured platform for dialogue does not give us space to deal with the irritations in our relationship in a systematic manner. And sometimes these were showing up, particularly within the multilateral sphere. But I want to stress the point, because this tends to be misunderstood. Our relations with the United States have always been good. We've always enjoyed, had points of disagreement. In fact, the United States, over a number of years, has been one of those countries we've enjoyed a positive trade balance with. And slightly because South Africa has been one of the biggest beneficiaries from AGOA. And the classical example, for example, is on the auto sector, the numbers of cars that we are exporting to the United States, which obviously reflect positively on our trade. Canada, I think the big achievement at this time was really the air services agreement that was signed in the course of 2009. But otherwise, our relations remain good. In Latin America and the Caribbean, again, continue to have good relations, work with Cuba and NAM, more, increased contacts with Argentina and also formally participated in the South America Africa Summit. Now, here there's a list of meetings that took place with Europe, too many for us to, and the number of visits that took place to here, if only to underline the fact that Europe is very important for us. 40% of our bilateral trade is with the greater Europe, probably about 33% with the European Union countries, and when we add the whole of Europe. So it remains a very important partner for South Africa. And in fact, when we engage with many of the powers in Western Europe, we also work with them with respect to the advancement of the African agenda because of the proximity of Europe and their interest in the continent. Now, I won't talk about the World Cup. So much has been said about it, but we played the little that part we had. We also continued with our attempts to really open up avenues with respect to Central and Eastern Europe, and I think we're successful in that, trying to leverage the possibility from that part of the world. State protocol, a lot of this is just to give you a sense of the scale of what we try to do here. 87 ceremonial events, 168 incoming and outgoing visits, number of summits, state protocol lounges that facilitate the movement of 26,700 people, and at the same time manage the number of diplomats who are based in South Africa, and then of course the work that we're doing establishing a state protocol lounge in Lamesi in Durban, and all of that has been achieved. You see that the diplomatic community in South Africa consists of 297 accredited foreign offices, which enables us to hold on to the second spot in the world, second only to Washington. And these are the new countries that established their presence in South Africa in the course of 2009-2010. Now, one of the things that we focused on a bit, which I'm sure is an issue that is close to the hearts of the excellences, because I know that the committee is also doing the same, is really the public participation program, so-called outreach program, and of course the minister has been to Limpopo, Eastern Cape, and the Free State, both to give lectures, to interact with the universities, but also to meet the community far much more broadly. Now, we just put up the objectives of the public participation program. I think this, the members are familiar with, so I will not spend time on. Then we, of course, pat our shoulders, pat ourselves for the good work that South Africa Inc., and of course, like anything else that is good, we also claim that we made a contribution to that, and that we indicate that as we prepare for the Olympics. Now, the financial statements, the honorable members, this is how they look. I think the important figure for you is that we spent 97.6% of the budget that we had been given. This is the same thing, just the difference is just the change in the categories. One was by programs, the second, this one is by economic classification. Just to indicate that the Auditor General's report is an unqualified audit report with no matters of emphasis, and I can see Ronima Moyepa is dying to be back to those days when he could say that. Welcome, Ronnie. And just to say, this document that we've given you speaks far much more to that, just to show the path that we've traveled over the past 6 years. Now, the under expenditure is really related to the Shanghai World Expo, largely because we had some money and Expo was going to extend it to the next year. It relates to Capital Works Program, and this Capital Works Program is largely the work that we're doing in Athens in our mission and in Abuja, and largely this. Most of it was work already completed, but what had happened, I'm told that a builder, sometimes it takes about 2 months or so before they can give you the final receipts, but sometimes also you build into the contract that part of the money you will only pay once you've moved into the building. And we've seen that there are no major snags in the building. So that this was about it. and this money was rolled over. The Pan-African Parliament, we made a presentation to the committee presently. You're familiar with that. And then on the two other key things that we, I must say, we were very happy we achieved during that time was the seamless migration, particularly on the ICT side, as we move from the many sites that we're occupying into the new building. Of course, the movement into the new building itself was a major activity. Streamlined our processes around procurement, again, further improvements on that. And, of course, members, the purchase of the Oliver Tambo House in London, where OR used to stay and put that as part of the extension of the properties of the South African Mission, with a view at some point to making it a monument of some sort. These are some of the management of fixed assets, some of the things that we focused on. Addis, Maseru, project design in those five countries, and of course I've already spoken about Lamesa. A huge, huge investment that we're making currently is bullet number two, which is basically the structural upgrade and renovation of what was the official residence and chancery in Washington, but essentially we've taken a residence and a chancery that were combined, and we've basically bought a new property as the residence for the ambassador, and we've collapsed these two, renovated it, and we're breaking walls to establish a decent big chancery in Washington, because we were already too many now in terms of the other departments that are also participating. As a result, we're using different facilities. So this is a huge investment that we are involved in. I must say we've continued the work of improving our financial management, improving our asset register. I guess the manifestation of the extent of the improvements that we've effected is in the unqualified report, I must say. Now, these are just a number of things that we wanted just to highlight around the issues that had been raised previously that we paid some particular attention to in the course of this year. The issue of partner departments, the extent to which they pay us on time so that they do not negatively affect our cash flow, and also to as some form of debt management. We've now MOUs with all the major departments, which enables us to handle the issues of finance far much more properly. The issue that we continue to improve is, of course, around the performance information, and here we've established a quality assurance team that reviews this on an ongoing basis. I want this is far much more to indicate some of the processes that we've put in place to try and improve governance within the department. The African Renaissance Fund, also unqualified audit report with no matters of emphasis. Income, that was it, and the expenditure, that was it. The reason we slowed down also on the expenditure on the African Renaissance Fund is that we did not want to have too many multi-year commitments in anticipation of the change to SACPA, so that we don't have SACPA does not carry too much of commitments that sometimes may not fit nicely with the new direction of SACPA. This is just some information related to our consular services, and just to say again, fortunately, there were no major catastrophes that we faced during this time, and most of the work with respect to South Africans abroad, and I mean, were all sort of routine issues. So, and we continue again to strengthen our consular support, because we are increasingly finding that is one of the areas where the demand is increasing with respect to our services in the generally because of the increased mobility of South Africans currently. Chair, that's really where I want to end, but let me once again conclude by thanking my colleagues. And just to say, Chair, let me assure the committee that we will continue on this path, continuously search for ways of improving the level of governance within the department, and so that as Mkho was saying, that so that things don't start falling again. The problem with getting unqualified audit reports with no emphasis of matter, no emphasis of matter, is that you essentially have to battle to keep it there, because any other thing is seen as a downward slide. But I must say, I really want to pay tribute to the team, particularly in finance, the internal audit. Let me recognize our audit committee, our HR, and of course our political desks, for the continued encouragement and working with the missions to make sure that our systems of governance are adhered to. Chair, thank you very much. And maybe let me conclude by saying, overall, I think that in 2009-10 we did meet broadly the objectives that we had set ourselves. So I think really there would be whatever shortcomings were there, I think these are things that in the course of 2010-2011 we should be in a position to try and correct. That's all.
Let's start with questions of clarity. The DG is left with 30 minutes. No, yes, 40 minutes. I will start with Honorable Korenov and then go to Honorable Mubo and then just take the line. For now, you raise the maximum of 2 questions. 2 for now, before the DG runs. Now, just raise 2 for now. You will have a second bite. Honorable Korenov, all of you, 2 questions.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me at the outset thank the DG for a very thorough report and in detail in a short period of time, highlighting the critical issues in the department. We appreciate your effort and the report. Can I start on a negative note, just to comment on the format of your report? It's not a user-friendly report. Jokingly, we may consider to use it for self-defense or book it in separately at the luggage at the airport. Maybe you can just comment on that. There's pages where you have only 2 pictures on. There are pages which are 80% blank. In your performance measurement, there are page after page with no heading. In one of your pages, you have a total unauthorized expenditure of 104 billion rand. Just wrong comma of full stop. I think there may be some room for improvement in just making it a neat report in terms of the presentation, of in terms of the layout, in terms of the format. So it's not a negative, it's just a comment that I want to make, and other members can either support or reject it. But I think we just want to make a opening remark as far as that is concerned. It's not criticism, positive criticism. It's not user-friendly to us as members. I'll stick to 2 questions. In the minister's report, she talks about regional integration being consisting of 3 pillars. Political unity, economic integration, and infrastructure development, which we support. Can you just update us the progress made with regional integration? I'm talking SADC. And especially, let me stick to that, just progress made with regional integration. The second question that I want to pose is, before I come to the second question, I want to support the chairperson's remark of an unqualified audit report. But in addition Comrade Chairperson, also for a department to have no irregular expenditure, no fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it's all clean. I think that you really need to be commended on that achievement. My second question is on your performance information on page 67 onwards, and that is that some of these measurable outputs are vague, and we cannot follow it easily to say this was a measurement, this was the ideal, the benchmark, and then when you come to the actual achievement. From time, and I'm not going into details, but I can show you some details. It's vague, there are not time frames, no timelines, and you tend to lose how to measure your achievement against your stated objectives. Those are my two questions, whether you can improve on that and whether you can assure us that you have the information available, but for some reason it's not published yet. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to join the chairperson in congratulating the department for our admission to the UN Security Council. And I hope that this time around we're going to use this opportunity to achieve what we failed to do in the last round when we are part of that body. Secondly, I also just want to say I think the report looks very impressive. Large, impressive, but I would be interested to know how much it costs to produce, because I think it's massive. But my questions of clarity are the following. I noticed that overtime payments escalated between the years 2008-2009 and in the previous financial year to almost three times the amount, and I want to know what the reason is. And also the high turnover among senior staff of the department, I think that's it's a reflection that maybe there's something that the senior staff are not satisfied with the department. I mean, if you consider that a career in foreign service or in the department is something that's so much sought after, that then you have this kind of a high turnover, I think it's something that you should worry about. And lastly, what's the status of the white paper on foreign policy that's been talked about? We've not been updated on that, and I'd like to know what the status of that is. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Is it me? Mugu, be in line. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG, and your team, and Dr. Mamuek. My question is, one, the issue of managed migration, especially in Africa, is of fundamental importance to South Africa in the wake of intolerance attacks against foreign nationals of African origin. What was South Africa's input in the approach to be taken to manage migration towards the finalization of the AU Convention on Protection and Assistance of Internally Displaced Persons in Africa? I would like to get a clarity on that one. And also, Chair, I would like to appreciate that we are aware that lately there is a move to take South African officials to be in regional and international organizations. My question is this quota fully allocated? And also, do we provide the necessary support for such officials? Like, I met my former colleague, Madasa, who has just joined the PAP, but apparently he was struggling with the language. He is a foreigner in his own country. So what type of support do we provide to such officials? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think let me join the chorus of my colleagues who have congratulated the department, especially for having three conservative, unqualified reports. And also thank the DG for a mouthful analysis or outline of the annual report. I just have two questions as per your request, Chair. The first one is the issue of, I've always hammered on the issue of national interest. And I see we have participated in many of these multilaterals and binational, and we don't give quite a lot of emphasis on the issue of participation. Do we participate merely for participation, or is there any meaningful diplomatic value that we are getting? And we don't get that from the DG. Maybe it might be something that we might need separately from the DG, just to at some point give us a synopsis of those engagements that we participate in and what are we getting out of it in terms of our national interest. He's just given us just a brief report of where the president has been and blah, 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 but without going into what do we get out of those things. And I don't see any reference to the issue of the MDG, the Minilam. I think we're coming from the era of assessment of the MDG in the UN. I don't see the DG referring to that. And on the HR side, you'd recall, Chair, when we were at the Limpopo campus, the student said, but yes, you do have this career exhibitions, but they don't come to the outskirts of these universities. They only center around Johannesburg and Wits and the University of Pretoria, but they don't go further than that. Is that the actual truth, or have we had movement into going to the outskirts of our provinces to encourage future career diplomats or young talent to come into the system of the and I must say, when this HR report looks quite a little bit gloomy, you know, and it's congratulations to the ambassador designate. I hope she's going to an ice cream posting, not the hardship one. But, Chair, further than having said that, I think those are my two questions that I would just want to pose. Thanks.
Honorable Dutch and Makama and Manana.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask around this Marangi diamond issue. South Africa was instrumental in facilitating the development, et cetera, et cetera, and then bringing the country back to full compliance. Who's monitoring that? How does the public play any part in that? Is there any, does the department have any sense in those situations what the public in South Africa would feel about that, especially in light of reports of the gross human rights violations and things, and how transparent is all that going to be in terms of feeding back to the public, because we are to some degree aware of that. And then in the health, with the presentation from the health department, they weren't allowed to answer anything to do with the medical students training in Cuba, because they said that that was an issue for foreign, for the international relations. So I didn't pick up anything in your report there, but apparently that's your baby and it's been in sort of work from your department. So I wonder if you could give us some detail around that. The kind of questioning there was really about, is it cost effective? Is there something in Cuba we can't give here? What are the pluses? What are the minuses? Are we spending more than we should be spending on training these students? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must start also by congratulating the DG and his team. This is indeed a market improvement on what they've done or what they've reported on in the previous year. You will recall, honourable members, Chairperson, that there were some matters that were flagged by the Auditor General, which I've noted that the department this time around was able to address. So clearly, there's work going on there with the department. But certainly, Chairperson, you see, these improvements are not heard of in the public sphere. I'm sure if the department got a qualification, the newspapers and televisions and all, the entire media would have been Chairperson, the issue of SADPA, for the past year or so, we've been told about this new development. However, it's time, Chair, that we get deadlines in terms of when, you know, the ARF will be wound up and SADPA will be established and operationalized. I recall in one of our last engagements, the department mooted to us that indeed there is the process was still in a conceptualization phase where they were putting together the entire thing. The report in front of us says that there is still work continuing on this matter. I think we need to move to a phase where we begin to see progress in terms of its establishment and operationalization. So that's the one. The last one, the issue of economic diplomacy training. Chair, we have seen more emphasis by this current administration being placed on economic diplomacy. We have raised this matter in a previous engagement as well with the department to get a feel of the economic diplomacy training that they've indicated to us will take place now. Perhaps the question is whether indeed that economic diplomacy training is taking place, and if so, what are the details? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Manana.
Without really, you know, wanting the details of how much it cost and everything else, but just to make an emphasis that really we could save much more if we can avoid producing reports of this nature. It's more of an album, and look, Chair, it's fine if it could be presented to the President that this is the annual report of the department, but not to us. We are fine with these papers here. So I thought, Chair, I should just raise that. But Chair, let me also go to look. We obviously congratulate the department as well. We see here that it's been rated second best employer of choice by tertiary students, studying towards qualification in humanities. And that about 15 unemployed youth completed a human resource learnership program, but we are not getting a sense of how many young people are incorporated into the system in terms of your employment equity. You have a status of women, status of people with disabilities, but no status of youth. Probably that can also assist in ensuring that we see that indeed, as you tell us about these achievements of being rated second best, but we see that there is some level of, you know, incorporating or some intake of these young people into the system. Thank you, Chair.
DG.
very much. Let me start with the Alba. let me not debate this. Let me argue. Let me concede the point. I will not absolve myself of the responsibility. That was my first reaction when I saw it. I had thought that we would stick to the format that we've used, but that's what under the bridge. The annual report was printed. It's not a cost issue, it's a design preference. The people were designing thought that they were trying to innovate, and unfortunately the process of innovation did not seek. We assumed it was going to follow the same path that we've done. And as I say, it's not an issue of cost, precisely because a lot of our work is done internally. So the cost, I'm sure, I just don't have the figures offhand, but all of this, the only thing that's done externally is the final printing, but all the layout, the design, all these things are done internally. So let me, rather than taking it as a stinking criticism, it's a constructive criticism. I must say, maybe to an extent, I also delighted that that was not just a superficial impression I had, but I must apologize for it. But as I say, it was an issue of giving a bit of leeway to our designers to do it the way that they would wish it, quite clearly. So we'll take, but I'm sure we'll not absolve ourselves of that responsibility. It was just an issue of preference on their side, but we'll respect that. The issue of Honorable Kwasnov, I would take also the criticism around, we struggle in the department around the issue of performance indicators. Lastly, related to the fact that quite a lot of the stuff that we do is also affected, I mean, it's circumstantial. It's affected by so many other things. And so when we put, and also putting these outputs, when we're dealing sometimes with quality of things, it's sometimes difficult. So I would concede that this is an area that we've battled over time and we continuously try to improve it. So I would accept that criticism. You've pointed at some, but what I would assure you of is that to the extent that some of the detail may not be in the annual report, that detail would be available in the department in respect to the question that we're raising. I've dealt with the issue of, I'll come back to the other question you raised. I've dealt with the issue of the cost of the report. On the overtime payments, there are specific units in the department that I suspect that would explain for the significant increase. We had two specific areas where we had, and Mato can add on this, where we had contestation about the levels at which we were employing people. But this is not something that was to be determined by the department, but it was going to be determined centrally by DPS. They went through a cumbersome process that's taken about 9 months to resolve. At the end of the day, the conclusion was that the department was correct. But of course, that is being taken to the labor court by the union concerned. And this has to do with entry levels and things like that. Now, the problem with that is that for as long as that is reduced to the level at which you are employing people, now you can't suddenly employ new people on the basis of the disputed. Now, and this happened also was negatively affected by the fact that one of those areas, we needed to beef up the establishment as we moved to the new premises because the demands of the new premises were high. So what else could we do? It was an area where we were discouraged from getting private sector companies to come and support. So the only best we could do was to deal with the overtime. So that's part of the contribution. But I can give you the assurance that we've got a system of controlling overtime payment in the department, and to the extent that there's overtime, I'm sure we'd be in a position to explain. Mato, you want to add to that?
You will notice that the overtime is in two areas, in admin and in program one, which is admin, and in program three, which is protocol. Now, one of the things that created, in addition to that, was that with the inauguration last year, we had to provide a lot of protocol services overtime, which created a lot of overtime, and that is reflected in program three. And what DG is talking about will be in administration security, which is program one. Thanks.
Thank you very much. On the high turnover of senior staff, this is, and again, we can come to it. Some of this is, remember that in terms of our balance for people deployed as heads of missions, who are in the senior management, which is why it's reflected as that. We have compared to probably other more settled administrations and democracies, we still have a disproportionately higher level of what we would call political appointees, as opposed to current diplomats. Now, at the end of the four-year term, those changes do take place, and in fact, I can tell you that my sense is that when four-year terms of contracts end coincide with an electoral period, you tend to get these sorts of fluctuations. So part of that is more reflective of that, rather than, as would be implied, that suddenly senior managers are not happy with staying in the department. I don't think it's in there. It's that sort of thing. I'm a civil servant. I should be measured in the words I use. I don't talk about cater deployment. The status of the white paper, can I just make a general statement? The problem always with presenting annual reports is that you're trying as much as possible to talk about the period 2009-2010, which essentially is the period that ended in March, 31st of March 2010. So a lot of the work, and you will recall that the commissioning of the white paper was actually during the budget speech of the minister, which was after that time. So in a sense, I have not given progress on that. But I can tell you that we've opened up a process in the department where we've put what we call essentially a non-paper to stimulate the discussion. There are a lot of discussion that's taken place internally in the department between 15th and September. The deadline is 15th of October. For all the units, all our missions to discuss that. We've got meetings that are scheduled for the 25-26 with the academic community in South Africa. We've got meetings scheduled for the 27th with the business community. And our attempt is to make sure that we enrich the white paper before we can actually bring it here. And then we've got a meeting at either the last days of October or early November. We are bringing all the government departments together to reflect on the white paper on foreign policy. Now, at the end of all of that, on the basis of the non-paper that we're discussing, we will amend, update that, and our time frames that we're working on is somewhere between the 10th and the 15th of November. We should have a draft that the rest of Parliament will begin to engage. That's where we are with the white paper. Process is, the problem with it is that we really are trying to have it as participatory before we actually put out the final, or at least the advanced version that would still be subject to review after the portfolio committee has had its own public hearing. But I must say, I'm comfortable with the progress that we are comfortable with the progress that we're making on the white paper. We have not provided fully for our quota in terms of the positions in the multilateral system. But I must say we're trying to do that. So one of the announcements that we'll be making soon, we've just had three officials of the South African government at relatively senior levels who are taken by the Food and Agricultural Organization, which is a good development. Now, we have never really designed a systematic program of support for those individuals, I must confess. But in the case of Mr. Madasa, it's a slightly different situation. Because Honorable Madasa, in a sense, we are sponsoring the Pan-African Parliament. So we've got a vested interest in his success. And so in the case of Honorable Madasa in particular, there is a far much more regular interaction between the department and him. And in a sense, we've opened the doors in terms of the sort of assistance that they think he needs from us in order to enable him. Because, as I say, we also have got an interest as we put in all those resources to make sure that we have levels of comfort that we can explain to the South African public what it is that we're investing. I also have not made reference on this on the MDGs for the simple reason that I think a lot of the focus of the MDGs was in the current financial and 2010-2011. That's really would be the only reason, not because it's not a... I would contest the view that would have been expressed in Limpopo in particular, because actually from the universities of Limpopo, both Venda and the former TEF, we get quite a number of students who've entered our cadet program. In fact, those particular universities, I think one of them has got a very strong unit on whether it's African history or political studies, from which we are recruiting. And in fact, we had some of the members of the faculty, certainly at the University of Limpopo, participating in our training program. So I think I would really love to get the details of that. Even in the current group that is there, disproportionately, we find that there's far much more. And of course, once we've recruited from those sort of institutions, the word spreads around it, so we're getting more applications now from those institutions. But really, we've tried to deliberately go out to the more rural provinces in the selection of the cadets. Now, on the Marange Diamond things, just to say, Honorable Dudley, that the Marange, remember what's happened here, is that you've got an area in the eastern part of Zimbabwe. Suddenly people pick up diamonds. There's a diamond rush. A lot of this is illegal. Then comes in all that period of what we call human rights abuses. The military claims in. But then we go through a process whereby licenses are given to private entities with partnership with the states to mine legally the diamonds. Then the Kimberley process comes in. What we are referring to is that South Africa indeed played a key role in the Kimberley process in the design of the plan, which is really the benchmark that Zimbabwe needed to comply with in line with the Kimberley process before those diamonds can be allowed to be sold. Now, the person who's a monitor is an independent person, is not representing the South African government, is employed by agreement of the Kimberley process. It so happens that that person was a South African who had worked in the diamond industry, A.B. Chikane. But he presents his report not to the South African government, but to the Kimberley process. And the Kimberley process then makes a determination whether Zimbabwe indeed is complying with the terms. And in the last report, as you know, they had actually felt in the World Diamond Council meeting that was in Russia that substantially that they've complied with that. Hence, they allowed the tranche of diamonds, but it was again circumscribed. It said it must be diamonds from these two particular entities because we examined them. Diamond that would have been mined outside the demarcated area would not fall into that until, again, due process in line with the Kimberley process has been. So in our sense, we are comfortable that we will put no additional obligations in South Africa because we are members of the Kimberley process. We are comfortable with the conditions that have been put on by the Kimberley process. The big problem that has arisen with respect to this is that sometimes there's an issue that some of the diamonds is mined in land that has been part of the land redistribution program, which then raises other issues. But the Kimberley process in its criteria does not have criteria related to the issues of ownership. It is about the issues. Remember, it was something around blood diamonds. So it would be sensitive to issues where violence has been used, particularly in the trade in diamonds. But in terms of the benchmarks that were there, it was discussed, we have an official in our department who actively participates in the Kimberley process, and it keeps us updated and quite clearly whatever we would say there in the Kimberley process would be in full respect both of our own values here, you know, but more importantly, in terms of the general consensus within the Kimberley process. So that's where we are. I'm surprised the colleagues from health are ducking their responsibility about training of students from Cuba. Okay, but I can say very briefly, and I really will speak now, not so much because this is something that DECO is supposed to follow very closely, but because the program was initiated when I was in health, so I know about the program, and it has substantially not changed. Now, the primary motivation for taking students to Cuba needed to balance cost versus orientation versus dealing with the historical issues of students in South Africa who came from disadvantaged backgrounds. So we needed to look at those three factors. That's how the program was conceived. Now, the first one around cost. During the visit of Fidel Castro to South Africa, when he read that there was a lot of noise in South African media about how costly that program was, which in fact was not exactly true. Nevertheless, in a meeting in the presidential guest house, he surprised everybody. He said, send the students for free. Now, when he said the students, and that hurt South Africa, I must say, I didn't think it was the right thing. He did it, but we knew it was out of irritation of the public discourse in South Africa. And his statements were, if these students don't pay, Cuba will not be poorer. We are already poor. And even if they pay, we won't be richer. So they can come. That's the first thing. The second one. The second one is that when those students were taken to Cuba, the conception was that let's take students from disadvantaged universities. Now, are those courses offered in South Africa? Yes. Would those students have gone into medical school in South Africa? No. And the reason is simple. South African medical students, medical schools, choose students with A's and B's. Indifferent completely to whether this child has been in a model C, has been in an urban area, or has been in a rural area. What the Cubans did, they said they've got experience of taking students with potential. But the argument that we was always there, that the students who get a C in mathematics and stay in and studies in a rural area probably has got far much greater potential than a student with a B who's been up through the model system. So what the students did, they took the students, gave them a bridging course in the physics and maths, and then put them through the medical program. So that's the second thing that we're doing. But remember also, at the time this program was started, an issue still very relevant to South Africa today was the attraction about the orientation of the Cuban medical curriculum, which was around the new strategic direction of the country, around the philosophy of primary health care. So the idea was that let's have some young students who begin to understand what primary health care in the greater so that as they come back to operate here, they could also spread their influence. Precisely because, in reality, our medical schools, even today, still have a strong curative bias, and therefore may not be your best agents, and I say this very, very delicately, about the orientation that we're trying to do. Not all of them to the same extent. I will not argue I would be wrong to say there's not been substantial progress made. Nevertheless, the Cubans have been at this game for a long time. So, in effect, I think from that point of view, it was cost, it was orientation, it was also the type and profile of student who get that opportunity. So, to that extent, our evaluation is still that the Cuban program is to the best interest of South Africa, which is why, as I understand, Minister Mtswaledi is thinking of even increasing the quota of the students who are taken in Cuba, especially in the current environment. And again, I'm stretching a bit on this issue, that the challenges that we have in the health sector fundamentally reflect major, major weaknesses of a human resource kind, more than anything else. And so until we address those issues, and where we can source help, we must source help from anywhere. So that is the argument from us and from an international relations point of view We don't see any problem with that. Now, thanks, Madam Honourable Member. On SADPA, I take the point, it's a criticism, I accept it. I don't want to talk about, there are some internal delays with the approval of what we need to bring forward, but we will try to fast track that. Economic diplomacy, part of the reason I suggested that we bring economic diplomacy training and have a discussion on economic diplomacy is that I don't think I can do justice to it in a short space of time. But I can tell you we're satisfied on our side that working with the DTI, we've designed a program, we've revamped the curriculum in our training academy in order to incorporate significant parts on economic diplomacy. We've been having workshops now that have brought in people even from the international relations departments of provinces in order to train on economic diplomacy. The big difficulty is not so much on the training, it's sustaining that when people are then deployed. Now, the way we're trying to deal with that is the discussion we're having with the DTI, for example, by having a major consultation with the DTI on the 27th. Key at the center of that consultation is for them to have refined their strategy of deployment of DTI personnel. And what we've really proposed to them is that let them accept that DICO has got a bigger footprint. DTI at most can have about 20, 25 people that they deploy internationally. But let those people far much more act as a regional resource for the officials where essentially are going to be driven by DICO by and large, except for the major economies. So that these people who've gone through this curriculum of economic diplomacy, who themselves are not diplomats, maybe political science students, maybe students in international law, so that when they go to the mission, they can get sustained support. And that sustained support can only come if we partner with the DTI. And I think that's what we are battling with, trying to refine, to improve the effectiveness of the deployment program. But in terms of the curriculum, orientation of the department, I think this is something that personally I believe that substantial ground. But I think, Honourable Member, maybe it would be far much better if there was a specific input, just focusing on that issue so that we can go into the details on what we are doing. On the status of the youth, we don't have the figures there, but I'm sure we can give you, but the department has changed substantially over the past few years. And in fact, I think the department, one of the, from an organizational culture point of view, in fact, you can see that change, even if you don't have the data, is palpable. And it's palpable because there's a difference between an organization that has largely 50-year pluses and 45-year pluses. And when you've got more youth, the dynamics of the organization change. Now, so we can provide that data. Also, the thing that makes one comfortable about it is that our cadet program targets people from the... It's virtually impossible now for people from outside the organization to get into DICO. People tend to move through the cadet program now. And these people in the cadet program are your 22, 23-year-olds, essentially. Because these are people who are just leaving university. So if we were to look at the entry level, for example, in the department, it's all people, or probably 80-90% will be below 25. And so, but we can provide those figures to the honorable member. Yes, my turn.
Honorable Member Manana also was raising the issue of saying to what extent do we then absorb these young people that we bring onto different programs, whether it's learnerships or cadets. Just to say to you that almost 100%, but it's not guaranteed. And we make it very clear upfront when they join any of these programs that there's a criteria. If you look at our cadet program, we make sure that on the theory part, that they pass a particular mark. On practicals, which is attendance and so forth, there are also standards. And last year, or during this reporting period, we had 52 young people that were in the cadet program. And I think we only declined about six, which is from, yeah, we only declined about 6. And even that 6, we went all out to try and see how do we really have to decline the 6. And after every manner of assessment, we decided that the 6 are not suitable for the department. The ICT learnership, which is another one where we target, because we do need skills in the ICT arena, all those kids or young people have been have been absorbed into the department within the ICT section. The HR ones, we also absorb. Finance, we also absorb. So, but again, like I said, there are standards and there's a criteria of, so we do absorb, and then in future we make sure that we indicate the absorption rate.
On the, maybe just on the regional integration, just to, I'm going to ask Mkhoyi to think about the national interest. But just on the original integration, I mean I think there are three elements that we're trying to use to look at the original integration. The one is basically political cohesion, the first one at the political level. I think by and large, I think we've registered significant progress. And one of the things that I think has been a big, big plus for South Africa over the past 12 months is the conscious effort and energy that the President has put onto engagement with the leaders of the region. The recent state visit by Botswana, his visit to Lesotho, we are receiving Kazan and Mozambique before the end of this year. He's been to Namibia. It's been to Mozambique. So all those things. So, and you feel it in the SADC meetings that there's far much more of that cohesion politically. So that one has been done. On the economic integration, the big issues, the big, big challenge that I think we South Africa has to think about, we talk about integration on the trade side. And I think on the trade side, there's a lot of integration that's taken place, especially with the establishment of the FTA. But we need integration also on the industrial side, on the industrial strategy side. For example, South Africa was just adopted our IPEP 2. But the IPEP 2 does not necessarily relate to the industrial strategies that other countries in the region are talking about. And I think that's the disconnect we need to move on. Until we correct that disconnect, there's always going to be this contestation, because when we think industrial strategy, we think of South Africa. When we talk trade, we talk about the region. And I think it's a bit of a disconnect that we need to leave. Part of the reason for that is actually quite objective. And the objective part, which is difficult, is that when we talk industrial strategy, South Africa has got an economy whose structure is completely different from the structures of the economy of the region. So to talk about a common industrial strategy requires quite a lot of conscious. So I think we need to work a bit on that. Then the third element around this integration is, of course, the free movement of people and goods. And again, there, two things have been done which I think are very good. South Africa has gone all out to basically introduce visa waivers for most of the countries in the region. I think now, with the exception of the DRC and Angola, if I'm not mistaken, all the others, the movement into South Africa, no visas are necessary. Now, that's a very significant thing to facilitate free movement. But of course, as you deal with that, you then get other contradictions, because we've now had to introduce the Minister of Home Affairs, had to introduce transit visas to the region. But this is now on account of minority consideration. So again, I think there's we can see a lot of effort and consciousness on South Africa to open up, to facilitate free movement, or greater movement of people and goods. But of course, there's a limit to that, in the sense that we then have to unify systems across so that we can deal with the issues of our security concern about, you know, people trafficking and all these other things that happen, which have forced us now to introduce these transit visas to the for people coming from outside the region. But for people within the region, they are there. So our overall sense is that I think there is progress. It's not as fast as we would like it to be, particularly on the economic integration side. And I think this is part of it needs to be unlocked on the political side. That's why I'm saying that we really are happy with the progress that we're making in terms of just the political consolidation of this situation, because really the issue of the EPAs, I think, opened up some wounds within the region. And we need to go to the process of healing, and so that we can look at these things. And then, of course, we're in a difficult situation in South Africa because, as we always say, countries in the region, I'm sorry to use this, but they tend to be schizophrenic sometimes in the way they relate to South Africa. At one level, there's this big brother that people want to work with, but at another level, there's the issues of national sovereignty that people want to assert. And of course, we also need to be sensitive to that in South Africa, and I think that's what we're managing. We're discussing it amongst officials. I know our ministers are trying to look at how best to close this gap so that we can promote this integration far much more strongly. So, national interest. I think the question was whether, in fact, these state visits, apart from enumerating them, there's palpable signs of advancement of our national interest.
Through you, Honorable Chairperson, thanks very much, Director General. Indeed, I think there is a very deliberate, a very a rigorous process through which we set out clear objectives for each of the engagements. And these objectives largely focus on broad political issues as well as on specific sectoral issues, particularly those issues that would contribute towards the realization of our own domestic objectives and goals as set out in the government's program, which relate in the main to issues of the economy and job creation, issues of health, issues of education, issues of development in the rural areas, as well as issues of crime prevention. So there is a very deliberate process of aligning our foreign policy engagements to the domestic imperatives of the Republic. I may just lift one or two of these visits to demonstrate the connection. We undertook a historic visit to Luanda last year. A state visit by President Zuma with a huge delegation, which has significantly contributed to the building of closer ties with the sister republic of Angola. And it has opened up massive opportunities for South African investors in that economy, which, as you know, is the fastest growing economy in sub-Saharan Africa, growing at a rate of 10% plus, and which, as you know, at one point had eclipsed Nigeria as the leading producer of crude in sub-Saharan Africa. But also, we know also today that Luanda is the most expensive city to live in the world. I don't think that's anything to be proud of per se, but I think it highlights the issues of the standard of living in the country, and also the availability of foreign currency, and the increasing number of the middle class in that equation. As a result of that visit, I'm sure members would have seen that Petro SA is on the verge of concluding a major agreement with Sonangol, the Angolan oil-producing company, which will contribute to the diversification of the sources of our crude oil, and increasingly ensure that we source our crude oil from the Gulf of Guinea,
reduction of the cost of sourcing our oil from the traditional oil producing countries of the Gulf of the Middle East, as well as the Persian Gulf. Again, the visit by President Zuma to Equatorial Guinea should be viewed in the same context, in the same light. So there is a symbiotic and a dialectic link between the visits that we undertake and the domestic imperatives of the Republic. Thank you. Honorable Mogo, did you hear that dialectical link? colleagues, let's take the second round. Do you want to focus on the finances? On the sense of you happy? Talked politics is enough now. Just for you to know that only about 4 years ago that the UNDP recognized Cuba as amongst those countries leading when it comes to accessibility to health. That's very important. That's very important about what South Africa is doing. Any further questions, colleagues? DJ, what are the... this ice cream? What are these ice cream countries? So that even myself, I look for such deployment later. What are the ice cream countries, by the way? Did they say there's something which has been raised with regard to the management of the revenue in the missions? That in some missions, the very nature of the policies of the countries of accreditation is such that foreign currency accounts are not allowed. And sometimes, DICO, you have to run you have to run those missions in terms of huge cash transactions. Certainly, in terms of the accounting standards, that's really not acceptable, and it will never be understood by the accounting standards. See, my various part, I must have. See, this is money bags, black money bags. In accounting, we use this. How do you deal? What is the strategy? What is the strategy in place to curb potential mismanagement and even fraud? I mean, the risk is very high when you have to deal with these issues. And any thinking between yourselves and even the AG's office as to what can be done in dealing with this particular. This is serious. This is serious business. That's the issue, teacher. The second one for me maybe it might be coming in the report of this. Of this financial year, next year. How far are you in terms of this, the issue of coordination? You know, I've been receiving numerous complaints in relation to, even amongst the departments themselves at the national level, let alone the chaos you see with the province. And even the local government in terms of the various exchanges and so on. I wonder if maybe that, if it's an issue to come later in the previous, that's fine, but I'm not sure if there's anything you can say about that. Thanks.
Chair, thank you very much. The ice cream mission. We categorize, there are four categories of our missions, Chair. 1, 2, 3, and 4. In fact, now we're just putting a motivation, which we are about to finalize for the fifth category, because we've come to the conclusion that there's a very big difference between Senegal and Guinea-Conakry. Now, so ice cream missions would essentially be category 1 and 2. This, of course, some of them. Incidentally, South Africa would be an ice cream mission. So many diplomats across the world regard this as an ice cream mission to them. So your Londons, your Washingtons, your Canada's, the G8 countries, your Scandinavian countries, basically the G20 countries. Those would be your category 1 and 2. Those were the ice cream missions. So called because the kids can get ice cream. And also because everything is there expensive, but at least you can have a decent life. The cash missions, I'll ask Mr. Gosso to talk about these cash missions, which maybe to put it into context. Mr. Gosso is our head of internal audit. And maybe the coordination one, Chair, just to say, we will be repeating what you are saying. Coordination is a major problem in our government. And we've come to realize that it's not so much an issue of the absence of a framework for coordination, because we designed it, we sent it to cabinet, we sent it to the previous cabinet. It's one of the few documents I know of that we took into the previous cabinet, and then we then say in order for ownership, we'll take it to the new administration, to this new cabinet. Adopted as it is, but coordination is difficult. And it's an issue of political will, it's an issue of strengthening administrative systems, and also it's an issue of understanding. So there are some decisions that have been discussed in the ICTS cluster to try and improve this coordination. But really, these are all more attempts to try to deal with this issue, which is really a big problem. So I don't think I can say more than that for now. We are planning, for example, if I can just say that our minister has proposed that we request a special slot in cabinet, not so much to discuss the document, but to talk about the issue, really to see what is it that further can be done to improve it, because it's a major, it still continues to be a problem. There's some improvement, I must be fair, there's some improvement, but nowhere close to how we should be coordinating. And there are some way it happens, the encouraging thing is that there are some sparks in some, it's not all darkness. There's some areas, and the key issues is how we can take those departments, those ministers, those provinces that seem to see the need for this and try to generalize their attitude. I think it's a big problem. Ambassador Gosso.
Thanks, Gigi. Thanks, Chairperson. Of course, the management of these are basic missions in cash-based countries, because we no longer have cash missions. In missions that are in cash-based countries, what happens is that as much as you have a bank account, but a lot of transactions are done using cash. An example, Sudan, because of the banking system that is not that credible, we get money from Abu Dhabi. Officials will carry that money to Sudan. Yes. And then you then bank it in Sudan. Now, the problem with that system is that if you bank dollars today and tomorrow or end of the month you want that money, you want to withdraw it and pay your bills, you are not guaranteed. You may not get that money. You may be limited. that you can only get, say, $5,000 a month from that. But let me just say, Chair, that ourselves, which is Internal Audit Deco and Auditor General, we're aware, which is why in our plans for each financial year, we target those missions. But there have been some measures put in place by the department to manage, based on the recommendations we've made, to manage those missions. Because one of the things that we had to do is to recommend the reporting mechanisms, the reconciliations that are supposed to be done on a daily basis in those countries. One of the countries, for instance, that we have, I mean, that environment is Nigeria. It's a cash-based environment. Of course, it's been improving. Angola is another example where we have bank accounts, but it's a cash-based environment.
Yes, I think we get used to these credit cards and checks. I mean, they don't operate everywhere.
Yeah.
And when you go to a bank, if you've got 20,000, sometimes you hear the money is finished. So you'll come some other day. I mean, that's the reality. So, and as Nyameko said, the only thing that we can do in those circumstances is just to design, which Internal Audit has helped with, design systems to limit the risk. But you're correct. Share your observation. The risk is there. If somebody comes from Abu Dhabi and suddenly decides or elects to say, no, the money that I've taken in Abu Dhabi got stolen on the plane, what can you say? I mean, it's a real issue. There are risks, but we try to operate within that and try to put whatever controls are possible in that environment, short of closing the mission.
I think we all agreed that the cut of the, what is it, or the withdrawal of the SABC service, Africa service and the world, whatever,
mm-hmm.
was unfortunate in terms of public diplomacy, just for interest sake. And as to whether there are any plans, it's outside, but it's a matter which has even come up in some other committee, and it was raised with us. Are there any plans between yourselves and maybe with the communications department to look into this matter, especially that we've introduced from last year in the new program on public diplomacy?
No, Chair, you are correct. I mean, we really mourned the fact that was stopped by SABC. We have raised it with them. We had actually, I know that Deputy Minister Sufana Merved actually raised it also with the CEO, with Soli, at the time. So I don't think we followed it up, but of course maybe we'll just wait for the situation to stabilize a bit and then follow it up. But really our view is that this is a huge, huge opportunity for South Africa that we're foregoing by stopping that service. I think we just opened up the space for and limit our ability really to significantly impact positively on the African agenda. So I think we share the views and certainly we also are trying to raise it with the relevant departments.
At this stage, any follow-ups? Yes, Makama. No follow-up. Honorable, yes. Yes, and then Honorable Koranov. We are going to release the
question. No, I'll be a bit out of order. I'll manage it. You'll allow me, I'm sure. Chair, now that it's in line with the matter you just raised. Now that we've secured the election onto the Security Council, Chair, what is absolutely crucial, Chairperson, is, you see, in the past, our positions, correct as they may have been, that we took, landed us in trouble with our own constituency. In fact, you read the papers, yesterday's papers, in
that view. And I dare anybody to challenge that position. Now, but you see, the one weakness, though, Chair, has been our inability to communicate these decisions in a coherent and a consistent way to be understood. You see? Chairperson, there's a lot of justification. In fact, there's every moral and political, you know, reason why we took some decisions that we took. In fact, if given the opportunity today, we'll probably take the same positions. Because those are perhaps the best positions we could have taken. But Chair, our inability to communicate. And I think we missed that. We seriously missed that. Now, so I want to really you know, make a clarion call to you, to the DG Chair, that the stage at the UNSC is another one. And he knows. In fact, I don't have to lecture him on it. But it requires that we communicate. In fact, to me, that's the one time when, in fact, really, public diplomacy, you know, became absolutely crucial and relevant, more than perhaps in any other instance in our. So please communicate, so that when you don't vote on Myanmar, mm-hmm. it is not taken, you know, as support for. You know, but it is understood within the correct context. Really, that's just my culture. Thanks for allowing me to be out of order.
We will equally, as a committee, take up this matter. We feel very strong when it comes to communication, even with the other committee which deals with communication. Honorable Koranov?
Chair, we need to let the DG go, but just one last question while you're here. For the first time, Parliament, from this year, if I'm correct, will engage in budget review reports. In other words, we are now in a position as Parliament to make recommendations to Parliament about the budget. Other different from what happened in the past, where the Minister presents a budget, it goes back, we just debate it, and it's cast in stone. Can I ask the DG whether there's anything that you want to give to the committee to consider for recommendations to Parliament regarding the current budget before us, based on that, because we're already now in the next budget cycle, just to assist the committee when we deliberate after we've closed this year, that we can take forward to say, yeah, this is the issue that we want to take forward to Parliament.
Also, can I just read in the statement we've prepared, just to emphasize the point which Honorable Magama is raising. The statement which I talked about on our successful election to the Security Council. We say here, during its last venture in the Security Council, South Africa took a well-considered, principled position. But some of these drew condemnation from critics both here at home and abroad. So it is expected that the Department of International Relations will this time around endeavor to take the people of South Africa along when confronted with difficult, complex issues. I think this issue is very important, so that everyone can feel that they have contributed effectively to the conducting of foreign policy and driving the state agenda of crafting a better world. That's a very important statement. So the issue sometimes is communication, and we think that the SABC was doing good work because the people were able now to give their answers to, this is what is happening. Listen to the criticism when some people are saying, why is the president going to China when there's this problem, and so on and so on. You see, so it's going to be very, very important that we up the what you call in this particular area. And thank you.
Chair, thanks very much. The first one on the Communication and Security Council, fully taken. I think it's a valid concern. In fact, just to say, before I came to this meeting, I was talking to our colleagues in the economic cluster, and we strayed into this conversation, and we made similar comments that it's not about just communicating; it's about the speed of communication. I think when if you looked at the content of our communication, I would still stand by it even today, even on those most difficulties. I think what beat us was lack of anticipation of the speed of the communication. In fact, I even think I was saying to somebody that now that we've got in the Security Council, as a classical example, by the end of November, we should have discussed all the items that are going to be on the January agenda and ensured about the briefs and started working on communicating our position. The issue of Myanmar, just to give a classical example of maybe an element of naivety on our side, but we were in Washington, former Minister Nkosazana, meeting with Condoleezza Rice, raised the issue of Myanmar. This was a few days before the Security Council, the resolution was put in, and it was in the first week of our membership of the Security Council. We voted on principle, did not anticipate the ruthlessness with which, whether it was principle, correct or not, but this is a media game. And so by the time we collected ourselves and tried to explain our reason, that's why I'm stressing the issue of the speed. I think when we were vulnerable to the speed, the other dilemma that we faced, and we'll have to nuance it better, we then started the process of having our own briefings here, but we were always sensitive about briefing about things that are still to be discussed, and we never got that balance right. And I think we missed the issue that once the decision is taken, the wires from Washington and London are all over the place and they dominate. Second point, which I think I said before, we were hurt most not by what foreigners said. We're hurt most when leading personalities in South Africa didn't seem to understand the basis of our decisions. And that is something we'll have to manage. So I think those comments, members of the committee, are really, really justified. This will have to up the game. And maybe as a tribute to my friend here, Ronnie Mamwepa, we struggled with Ronnie there. It's going to be a taller order now that he's not in the department, because he had a better grasp of international relations. So that is the issue. Now the issue of the issues of budget, Honourable Coroner. Just on my feet, I think the three most important ones that really would like the committee to really consider for us. The first one is that we terribly under pressure with the operational part of our budget. The choices, the stark choices that we're beginning to face is that if the figures in the MTF stay as they are, very soon we're going to have to reverse again and start closing missions. It's just not sustainable. So that is the first one. The second issue is that we have completely stopped, or rather stopped on the track, a process that we had started, which the committee had raised and felt strongly about, which is about acquisition of property. Now, the longer we delay it, of course, the more we're spending money on rents. In fact, now in some of the areas, we were told that rents are just arbitrarily increased up by about 40%. Now, this is very difficult for us to accommodate. So it puts further pressure. The third area that I really, apart from really the operational budget, the issue of the capital budget, there is a particular activity that we run the risk of losing an initiative that South Africa had actually initiated, which is good in our foreign policy, which is the issue, the work that we're doing with the diaspora. Now, one of the things that we actually needed to do was to continue the work that we had started, which was supposed to culminate in a big meeting of the diaspora in South Africa at summit level, which now is scheduled to coincide with 2012. Now, we really, really need to get this family on the agenda, because I think it would enable us to play a far much more meaningful role. So, offhand, I can think of those three honorable members. That's it. The other issue, the other issue, for the first time this year, we've had to battle with a debate with the Treasury around the calculation of the foreign exchange gains and losses. Now, I really do not understand. I mean, maybe we can bring in. Our people are insisting that the calculations that we've made are correct. We've looked at them. There's a contestation around that. Part of me thinks it's because the Treasury is under a lot of pressure financially. Now, the problem is that we are so much foreign currency driven that if that we don't handle that well, then we run into problems. So I think those are the four that I can immediately think of. But what I can do, honorable member, I can probably just give it also further reflection and submit to the committee. And maybe whilst I have the opportunity here, let me just conclude my part by thanking the committee most sincerely for the support. I must say, I know that there are times when you've called on us to come, and sometimes we've not come at the levels that we'd expect. And we really appreciate your understanding. But just to assure you that when that happens, it's really not because of any lack of trying on our side. It's only that sometimes it just becomes very difficult. And also just to thank your understanding at times when we've requested slight adjustments in your program, if you wanted to discuss this and the relevant people in the department, and that you've tried to accommodate us and adjust the dates accordingly. But again, just to say, we've always worked on the basis that what we require from this committee is effective oversight, and that part of that effective oversight has elements of criticism. But I really want to place it on record that with my colleagues, there is no time when we felt that criticism was not constructive, was not based on helping us up our game a bit, which is what we'd like to do. But most sincerely, thank you very much to the committee.
Let me take the opportunity on behalf of the committee to thank the DG and the department for the good work which we've appreciated as a committee. We will look into this report. We've noted everything. We're still going to go and consider it, make our own recommendations, and we will communicate back to the department and also follow our own internal processes in Parliament. We've come to the end of the agenda today, therefore we adjourn this session for now. We go. Thank you.
Can I respond on that thing?
No, I don't do.
Can I respond? It's cynical and counter-revolutionary.
I'm not counter-revolutionary. I'm counter-revolutionary. I'm talking about.